Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate on this hot summer afternoon. As a journalist and BBC News foreign correspondent, Bill Turnbull has reported from more than 30 countries and has had his share of adventures. He's best known in the UK for two of Britain's most popular shows, BBC Breakfast, which he co-hosts, and Strictly Come Dancing, the British version of Dancing with the Stars, where he was a contestant. But the thing he is passionate about and which has given him some of his biggest thrills is beekeeping. Despite his not-so-promising beginnings as an apiarist, including getting stung twice on his first day, he's now become a leading ambassador for beekeeping in the UK and the self-proclaimed president of what he calls the other BBC, the Bad Beekeepers Club. His new book, Confessions of a Bad Beekeeper, contains stories, how-tos, and how-not-tos of the hobby, and it's published by The Experiment, and I'm pleased to welcome Bill Turnbull to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
It's a great pleasure to be here, Julie. I have to say, 30 years ago, this month, 30 years ago, I came to New York to try freelancing as a journalist for a year, and I ended up staying 5 years. If you had told me that 3 decades later I'd be sitting in the studio
talking about bees,
talking about a book I'd written about bees, let alone bees on WMOC, you could have knocked me over with a feather.
You know, I think most of us look back and say, how did I get here? But the stories may not be quite as dramatic as yours. So, and I was expecting you to walk in full beekeeping garb, because this is radio, you need to play the part. So
it's too hot. Yes. For that. And these days, after 10 years keeping bees, I try to sort of divest a little bit more every year. So I used to start off with a full white suit and the veil. And then I moved down to just having a jacket and the veil. Sometimes, and I dispense with the leather gloves. I go down to sort of the nice blue kind of veterinarian's gloves. And sometimes I go without those and just go with the veil on its own. But sometimes you can go without the veil too if you're very brave and you've got very well-tempered bees.
Well, you describe your first experience with bees where the suit didn't do you much good because a bee got inside.
That's right. It was a bit of a dim thing to do, but it was my first day out with bees, and I had been slightly disoriented because I had been, before I'd even got the suit on, stung by two bees from a swarm which was nearby. And they kind of took a fancy to my head. I had some gel on my hair. I'd been working in the studio that day, and I think maybe they thought this would be an interesting kind of blossom that they could forage on. And they both got stuck, and I made a terrible mistake of trying to bat them away with my hand, which is the one thing you should never do with a bee. If a bee lands on you, just let it be. It'll be fine most of the time. And they got stuck, and I batted them, and they both stung me on the head, and it felt like being hit on the head with a hammer with a thumbtack attached. So there's that. And then I put on the rest of the suit. It's my first day out, thinking I just got to carry on. And I zipped up the veil, and then I looked, and I thought, there's a bee on my veil there. What's it doing there? It's having a look around. And then I thought, if it's on the outside of my veil, I should be able to see its belly, its underside, but I can only see its back. And then the truth slowly dawned on me. But I survived, and here I am.
And here you are. It sounds like it did not daunt you and your passion for bees.
No.
One of the things you write about that I found fascinating is that bees, each bee may not have much of a brain, much of a sense of things, but mm-hmm. that as a collective, the hive really does have a personality. You talked about, you know, the way you can work with bees if you've got a particularly well-tempered hive. What have you seen in beehives, and what causes the different personalities in the different swarms of bees?
Well, there are several different factors. One is the mother of the colony, the temperament of the queen. Because any bee that is inside that particular hive, 99.999% of them will be her children, although they will have several different fathers. And so it's what she's like. As she gets older, she will get a little bit more cranky and produce crankier bees. It also depends on the time of year. Early in the season, there aren't too many bees around, and they're much gentler. Towards the end of the season, especially from now on, when what we call the flow has finished, there aren't so many flowers in blossom to forage on, then they go, what we have, we hold. They get very protective of their honey. And if you go into the hive, they think, well, they're about to come in and nick it. So they'll be very protected. They get cranky then. When it's thundery, not a good time to go and
thunder.
See. Thunder.
That's interesting.
Yeah, they don't like that. And if you ever go near a bee, certainly in Britain, the old rule is if you open up the hive and it smells of bananas, just shut it up and walk away because they're ready to go berserk.
Bananas? Why?
I don't know. I've detected a sort of faint banana scent once, but it was nothing too much to worry about. But those are the different factors that you get. So they do change temperaments as time goes by.
When you were a kid, did you love insects? Were you one of those boys looking under rocks for things? Or was this a later passion?
Yeah, no, I never did, really. I've never been one for horticulture. I've always been more into husbandry. So I loved dogs when I grew up. I grew up on a small holding where my parents kept variously at different times chickens and geese and ducks and rabbits and all sorts, but never any bees. And the only sort of flying insect I came across regularly was a wasp. And the wasp and the bee, of course, are mortal enemies. And I was never fond of wasps. Not many people are, but there are some. There is a sort of wasp liberation front out there. I appeared on the radio last year in Britain to talk about the book, and I was rather rude about wasps. And they got phone calls and emails of complaint before the program was even off air. So I'm going to be diplomatic about it.
I remember we would have paper wasps growing up. And I loved looking at their hives, but from a long distance, because the wasps themselves were a little scary.
But I never imagined that I would ever take up beekeeping. And the interesting thing is, having started that, I've become more accustomed to dealing with other creepy crawlies. So spiders not a problem anymore. I can pretty much handle everything. So that's been a benefit.
Did it take some convincing of your family? I mean, you'd raised chickens, so you had experience with creatures, as you say. But did it take some convincing to say, hey, let's invite, you know, thousands and thousands of bees to live on our property?
It did, rather. The first bees I kept were in a bee yard some miles away, and then I suggested that perhaps it would be nicer to have actually some bees at home. And so I ran it past my wife and managed to persuade her. But my oldest son, Henry, said, "Bees in the garden? Are you trying to kill us all?" Now he's got used to it, and he doesn't keep bees himself, but I have. We have a flat roof garage, and to get into the house you have to come up a driveway, go through a little wicker gate, and then go up the steps to the house. And there is, on the roof of the garage, there are not one but two beehives with bees in them. And most people walk past, they don't even see them there. So that's how close they've got now to us. And it's great. It's great to wake up in the morning and see the sun shining, just see the bees zipping across the yard. It just makes you feel that the place is alive.
Now, there's a difference that I think many people don't know between honeybees and bumblebees.
Yes, there is. I'm amazed that people don't know that difference. Also, they don't know the difference between wasps and bees. I've been called out to deal with a swarm of bees, as it was called, and it turned out to be a bucket full of wasps, which is no good to me or anybody else. But bumblebees have been cleverer. They nest in a different way. So they don't all hang together in the colony. They each make a little burrow, and crucially, they do not create a surplus of honey that mankind can come along and steal. And so
they're not good farmers for us.
No. They are kept for pollination sometimes,
That's all right. We say tomato.
In the tomato greenhouses and the polytunnels, I think sometimes they do use them as well for pollination purposes. Why, I don't know. But they're wonderful creatures, bumblebees, because they fly longer. They fly longer in the season as well as longer in the day, and they'll come out when it's really quite cold. And they're just a fantastic size, and they seem to defy the laws of aerodynamics. They don't officially, clearly, but you look at it and think, well, how is that getting off the ground?
We have carpenter bees in fact, we had a few living in our house, and they're the same. They're just these big round things, and you think, how do they do this?
Yeah, but they're all good for the environment, you see, because they're carrying on the work of pollination, that sort of thing. So
honeybees are the ones that you're particularly interested in, and they're the ones, or are all the bees affected by these things that are really decimating bee populations here in the U.S.?
No, it's largely only bees that are kept by beekeepers. And there's a clue, really, isn't there? And we've had problems. I think there have been problems with beekeeping around the world, but we've had problems in Europe and particularly in Britain with the Varroa mite, as you have here in the United States, not with the same drastic consequences, but we're developing ways of managing it. It's just, for some reason here in the United States, your winter die-out rate is horrifically high. We had a couple of wet winters a couple of years ago, and bees don't like damp. They can deal with cold, but not damp. And when our die-out rate went up to about 30% over winter, we had beekeepers dressed up in their veils and suits marching down Whitehall with their smokers lit, demanding action. And they got some. But here...
What kind of action could you get?
There
what was it that was the...
The government sat up and listened, and they devoted some more money to research. And really, the beekeepers got it on the public agenda, got people to realize that there was a problem here that needed looking at. And so the Department of Agriculture is doing that now, which is a good thing. But here, if talk to some beekeepers here, and they're losing 60 to 70% of their bees every winter, and having to start again, it costs them hundreds of dollars even for hobby beekeepers. And so they wouldn't mind a situation where we had a 30% die-out rate. Ours has gone lower now, losing less than one in five. So we may have passed the hump on that one.
And you write in the book about how, and you just said it now, it's the bees that we are messing with mm-hmm. that are having the biggest problems. And you write about how in the United States, at least, bees are being transported here and there to be able to pollinate crops all over the country.
Well, I'm going to walk on very thin ice here, Julie. So I hesitate to talk about beekeeping in America because obviously it's not something I know about, and not for nothing is it called Confessions of a Bad Beekeeper. But it does strike me there's a problem clearly with shipping bees in such great distances. It puts them under stress, and also there's a monoculture diet. So in other words, if you put the bees on almond orchards in California, the bees that live there, their entire life, that's all they will feed on. And then they'll move on to blueberries or something like that in Washington state. And that cannot be healthy. But there's a problem now of the scale of everything. The orchards are so big that they need billions of bees, and they've got to be shipped in from somewhere. So how that gets resolved, I don't know.
For you, you are working on a much smaller scale at home. Yeah. And I know here you can go into the supermarket and buy sage honey or larch honey. Or I've always wondered about that, though, because how do you know that the bees have just gone to those particular plants? So in your backyard, do you have a particular type of honey that you make?
No, I'm very grateful to have any honey at all, to be honest. But I did actually manage to, amazingly this year, I've been quite efficient and tapped and took off the honey before I came on this trip over here. Normally I leave it till September, by which time it's rained all of August and the bees have taken all the honey back. But there's a slightly minty taste to my honey this year, and that's because there are some lime trees nearby which only blossom properly every few years. And this year was one of those years, and you detect that minty taste. It's a very special flavor. Also, on the farm where I keep some bees, big clover fields, and you can taste that clover honey in it. When it says sage honey, it means it's predominantly sage that they will have been foraging on.
And honey has different colors, too, mm-hmm. sometimes. Does that depend on what the bees have been eating?
Yeah, indeed, absolutely. So buckwheat honey here, for instance, it will be
very dark.
Darker. In Britain, it tends to be the stuff that they feed on earlier in the season will be lighter, and as the year goes by, it gets darker. But it's not necessarily true. But darker honey will have a stronger flavor.
So was there ever a moment where you said, why did I ever get into this? I think I may have made a big mistake.
Well, the day I got stung on the head twice.
The first day.
It's usually when you get stung. And actually, then when I go home and I say to my wife, darling, I've been stung again. She says, where? And she says, oh, okay. So there is that. But I always say to people who ask me, why do you do it when you get stung? And the thing is, kind of, that's where the fun is. If there wasn't an element of risk and adventure, it would be like keeping flies. So it's a really, it's part of, it's exciting to do it that way. You know that unless you move respectfully and carefully and slowly, that you will be punished. And I've been punished plenty of times, getting better as time goes by. And the great thing is, Julie, it's really nice when the pain wears off.
It's that contrast from one thing to another.
Yeah.
And I've heard some people say that bee stings are good for arthritis and for all of these other things. So you may enter old age feeling very well.
Absolutely.
So in a number of years from now.
Indeed.
And do you have a particular place that you like to go? Do you like to be with your bees?
Yeah. I think that's probably why I do it more than any other reason, because some years I don't get any honey, and that's fine. It's because when you go down to the apiary, to the bee yard, the sun is usually shining, and you take the lid off the hive, and you look in, it's like a little city, and every city has a set of questions to answer. Are there enough bees there? Are they still alive in some cases? Is the queen there? Is she laying? Have they got enough food? Do you need to make more space? All these sorts of things. And sometimes I sit there with a hive open and there's it takes me minutes to work out what I should do, and then I invariably, as a bad beekeeper, make the wrong decision, but that's okay.
You eventually get to the right decision.
Yeah, but it's peaceful. You know, and then you put it back together, and when you've gone through three or four hives, after a couple of hours, you come away and you've been concentrated so hard on one thing that your mind has just been washed clear. It's actually really quite calming and relaxing. It's nice.
It sounds like it does. It's like meditation, but a kind of active one where you can't not focus. Otherwise, you get stung.
It's a very sweaty form of meditation too.
Well, I've been speaking with Bill Turnbull, who has written a book called Confessions of a Bad Beekeeper, What Not to Do When Keeping Bees, with apologies to my own. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And this is from Experiment, The Experiment, and he'll be speaking tonight at the Arsenal in Central Park on 64th and 5th Avenue. You do need to RSVP. Just go to our show page at wnyc.org for the link. It's at 6:30.